Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On June 15th, 2009, 3 million people marched in Tehran, Iran, chanting, "Where is my vote?" In response to the disputed results of the presidential election, which officially handed Mahmoud Ahmadinejad a second term in office. During that protest, Mehdi Al-Avi, a 19-year-old young man who took part in the demonstration, disappeared. His mother, Zahra, and his brother, Hassan, started looking for answers and started on a long, painful descent through the Orwellian underworld of the Iranian theocratic regime. Amir, an Iranian-American human rights activist, and Khalil, a fine artist, tell this story in the graphic novel Zahra's Paradise. It's been translated into 12 languages around the world. Amir is co-author of Zahra's Paradise. He's a Bay Area-based human rights activist, journalist, and documentary filmmaker, and he joins us in studio. Hi, Amir. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks for coming in. Graphic novels cover a wide array of issues, and they're becoming a popular way of reaching readers of all ages. More graphic novels have been published in the last 10 years than in the last 30. Paul Buell believes graphic novels have been so successful because they offer insights that are not readily accessible in prose. Paul Buell is a retired senior lecturer of history and American civilization at Brown University and founder of the Oral History of the American Left Archive at New York University. Paul is author and editor of 42 books and non-nonfiction comic art books, including The Beats, A Graphic History, Che, A Graphic Biography, and Studs Terkel's Working. He also edited A Dangerous Woman, the graphic biography of Emma Goldman. Hi, Paul. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, and I'm very glad to be here and delighted to be with Amir.
Hi, Paul. How are you doing? Delighted to be with you.
Well, it's great to have both of you on. So, Amir, let's start off with you because the graphic novel world is very new to you. You're a journalist and you're a filmmaker. What really inspired you to tell the story of the Iranian uprising through a graphic novel?
I think the first insight that I had was that the Iranian people were telling their story through images. And those images were just coming at us from just about every direction. So everything that was taking place in Iran was visual. The green movement was, you know, it was defined by a color. The Azadi Square was, again, the main square where people gathered. That was defined, again, by a symbol. So these were very easy to capture in graphic novel format. But I think there were just sort of practical constraints. As a journalist, I couldn't be in Iran. It was hard to document what was going on. And as a documentary filmmaker, I know that when you're trying to make a film, you have, you know, it's expensive. You need a crew. You need a camera. You need all this, time. The lighting has to be perfect. You have to get there on time. Not so with the graphic novel. I was lucky because Khalil's pen recreated this universe that I was dreaming and imagining. So all you need for a graphic novel is a pencil. Really, and a little bit of imagination. So it's one of the most democratic forms of expression, if you will. It's available to everyone. All the kids who were in Tehran's streets, I mean, every single one of them was a graphic novel artist, in a sense. You know, their graffiti was all over the streets of Tehran. So why not ours?
Well, you make it sound so easy, but you know it's not, because I love reading graphic novels. Well, because you can flip through them so quickly.
Yeah.
But you can't, I mean, you can use, what, maybe 10 words in a sentence? I mean, you have to choose your words carefully, I assume, because you don't have much space. And you have to tell the story in a way that just really grabs people.
That was the greatest challenge. In some ways, it's the most liberating of art forms. In some ways, it really constrains you. And, you know, for years, I'd gone to great lengths trying to tell the world about what was going on in Iran, and I over talk it and overwrite it. So my brother actually jokes that this was God's punishment because I was forced to write in these small little blurbs. You know, it's like haiku. The beauty is that it forces you to distill the experience and put pack in emotion and information in as intense a form as you can. And that's where it becomes very exciting.
Paul, how long have you been working on graphic novels?
Well, I have to go way back. I was one of the people involved in the underground comics movement in the later 1960s and early 1970s, which found its home in the Bay Area. It's one of the most unique aspects of the history of comics, that it should have been there that things really began to go in a new and uncensored direction. I published a comic called Radical America Comics, which was a special issue of my SDS magazine, Radical America. And then I more or less published various smaller magazines interviewing comic artists in the intervening years, and by the 90s was writing a lot about them, but only as the 100th anniversary of the birth of the Industrial Workers of the World approached in 2005 did I see that it was possible to begin producing a nonfiction graphic novel. So Wobblies was the first one to appear in 2005, and I think I'm up to 8 or 9 by this time, with another one, mostly comics, called Robin Hood, People's Warrior and Forest Defender, just about to be published, and others coming along. So I've been doing it what I regard as full-time for perhaps only half a dozen years, but among the things I've learned is who are really talented storytellers, and Amir is an extremely talented storyteller.
Well, and I just wondered what goes through your mind when you hear someone like Amir, who's, this is new to him, and when you're talking about an issue like the Iranian uprising, he was trying in several different mediums to tell the story, and he finally just thought, you know, I think the comic book medium might be the most effective.
Indeed. I might say that the comic revolution of the 21st century was accelerated certainly by Marjane Satrapi's work on pre-revolutionary Iran. It's one of the most admired works of all, and the only one made into a black and white film. The work of Joe Sacco, among others, who are sort of reporters on the scene of wars and crises and so forth, has given readers and other artists the thought that they can do this. And now it's proliferating, and as in all new media, whether it's newspapers way back, radio in the 1920s, or television in the early 1950s, the fact that of newness brings a lot of fresh talent onto the scene, or at least it's capable of bringing it in. And another example of a Bay Area artist is a guy named Dan Archer, and he publishes something online called Arch Comics with an X. And if you go to Arch Comics, you'll find, among other things, his multimedia interview with people in occupied Oakland, where he both draws them and interviews them simultaneously. And these are forms which are just evolving. Dan Archer is really one of the most talented, but we're moving further and further along with these new forms, side by side with the rising social movements. In other words, it's a great moment for art as well as a great moment for social movements.
Well, it sounds like it's such an exciting time for graphic novels, and I recently read that more graphic novels have been published in the last 10 years than in the last 30 combined, and a lot of people are saying that this is just on the verge of exploding.
I don't want to take any of Amir's time away, so I'll be brief and say that while that's true, and whereas there's an enormous amount of wonderful new graphic novel-type material on the web, the book publishing world is in crisis.
Right.
And therefore, for artists to actually be paid, even very badly, is quite a struggle for me as an editor. Consequently, every project sounds like a great idea, but to carry it through is no easy task.
Well, later in the show, I'd love to ask you what makes a great graphic novel and how do you decide which one to work on. Amir, why don't you talk a little bit about your inspiration? Where did you get the inspiration, really, in terms of other graphic novelists?
Oh, for sure. I think two places. Paul's so right. Marjane Satrapi, who wrote Persepolis, she's from my generation, and I could relate to her experience. And she just showed me that this is something that can be done. Then what happened was that one of my dearest friends, A.B. Sina, wrote another graphic novel called Prince of Persia, which was published by First Second, and he sent me a copy. And I looked at it, and I thought, my God, this is brilliant. And the other thing I thought is, I can do this. This is fun. You know, I'd grown up on comic books in Iran, actually. Funnily enough, American comic books. Casper the Friendly Ghost, and, you know, all of these guys were there. Yosemite Sam, Bugs Bunny, you know. And it's amazing. And actually, even if you don't think of those, I had a cousin who would always force me to play Barbie doll with her when I was a kid. And really, a graphic novel is that you're creating your own Barbie dolls in a way. Or just characters, you know, and breathing life and voice into them. And what was really powerful, what was really strong for me is I grew up during the revolution. And so over all these years, different people have been telling me the story of what they went through when their loved ones went into Evin prison. So I had their voices, and I could put those voices into the characters that populate Zahra's paradise. The lucky part, of course, is that I can't draw for beans. and so I had seen Khalil's work, his sculpture, ceramics, and so on. And it was so close to, it had such a Persian touch to it. The eyelashes that he would draw, the blues that he had and things, that I just sort of pounced on him. And he's got his standards. So it took some persuading to get Zahra's Paradise going. But once we did, it was just, we were like two wings of the same bird. It was just flew.
What is the process like? Do you think about what story you want to convey and then put words to paper and then talk with him about the image that goes along with that?
Yeah, when we're saying we're co-authors, it's so true, because there's this tendency to think, okay, so one person's the writer, another is the illustrator. The way it worked was that I would write the story, imagine it, work it, send it to him. He would send me his feedback. We'd play around with it. Then he would do the drawings, send them back to me, and we would do the same thing with the images and illustrations. The tension came from the fact that we had to produce 3 pages a week, and it was like a newspaper. It had to be up on the web, you know, fast. And so this was actually done without any time for revision, or, you know, we really just had one shot at it. And I think being at the edge, it was like this was our big baseball game, and we had to get everything right. There are errors in it, of course, but the lack of a margin just made it so much more intense.
Well, I'm looking at the book right now, Zahra's Paradise, and on some of these pages, you've got 15 on one page. You've got 15 boxes.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about 15 different scenes on one page of a fairly small paperback book.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, what was funny is that Mark Siegel, our editor at First Second, initially said, okay, you're going to have 64 pages for Zahra's Paradise. And it was clear to me and clear to Khalil, I needed at least 2,000 pages for it. So the art came from being able to divide things into those 15 different panels. And Khalil was also experimenting with the panels. So at a certain point, the images start to break out of the panels. The panels start assuming their own forms. So the panels themselves become windows into Iran, which is quite fun.
That is Amir. He is an Iranian-American human rights activist. He and his co-artist, Khalil, tell the story about the Iranian uprising in the book Zahra's Paradise. It has been translated into 12 languages around the world, and we'll talk about how this has been received in different countries, including the U.S. We're also joined by Paul Buell. He's a retired senior lecturer of history and American civilization at Brown University and founder of the Oral History of the American Left Archive at NYU. Paul is author and editor of 42 books and non-fiction comic art books, including The Beats, A Graphic History, Stead Terkel's Working, and he also edited A Dangerous Woman, the graphic biography of Emma Goldman. And we'd love to hear from you in this conversation about graphic novels. What are some of your favorites? How do you think graphic novels, what can they do that prose cannot do? How do images really change the art of storytelling? What makes graphic novels unique? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255.
This is a rebroadcast, please. No calls.
866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Paul Buell, why don't you talk a little bit about the process involved in your work? Does it change based on the topic?
Yeah, of course. Being an historian, I should say that graphic novels really came out of the so-called wordless novels or woodcut books of the 1930s and 1940s. So in a sense, especially and most famously by a Belgian guy, Franz Masereel, but in the U.S. by a lefty named Lynn Ward. So Will Eisner, being seen as the inventor of the graphic novel, maybe it might be better to call him a reinventor, because the form sort of disappeared and then reappeared. And I think of this as a historical step with all of the complications involved in that, because after all, only in the 80s and 90s were comics considered by practically anyone in this country, at any rate, to be capable of rising above the abysmal level of Donald Duck. Those comics were pretty good, actually. But thought of as hopelessly juvenile, loaded with banal superheroes, that's true, and only rarely, as in the original Mad Comics and EC War science fiction comics of the early 50s before the suppression of comics, as being of real artistic and political sentiment. So when Harvey Pekar, my late pal, we collaborated in five books, declared that Dostoevsky could be produced in comics as well as in novels, hardly anybody took that seriously. And then Art Spiegelman's volumes, Mao's, appeared in the early 1990s, were acclaimed. He wrote the Pulitzer Prize. There was a Museum of Modern Art exhibit. And suddenly there was a different view by critics, not to say there were yet significant sales. Nobody was making a living. And then as it evolved after the turn of the century, it became clear that the variety of graphic novels was extremely wide, from books that are very dense in the number of words used. Good example, my newest book, Yiddishkeit, which is really an attempt to understand Yiddish culture as within Jewish culture in the last 700 years and its impact on American popular culture. Harvey Pekar wrote most of it, scripted most of it, and used a whole lot of words. Amir is also on the fairly many words line, but there are many other artists who really don't like to use too many words at all. Or another variation, when I'm described as being an editor of Che and Emma Goldman, it's true in a general way I saw the script, but these artists really don't like too much collaboration. Spain Rodriguez, real genius from the 70s generation, and Sharon Rudall, likewise, they really ran their own ship. And I was just a helper and organizer of the whole project, whereas there are other artists who are really good who want me to script every single word and describe the scene on every page and the breakdown and so forth. So all these things are possible. Also possible is color, which is rarely affordable except on the web. It's hard to do it in on the printed page because of the expense. And further variations of every type. There are even comics that have no narrative whatsoever. They're very artistic, and I find them instantaneously boring. But I see that as part of the ongoing experimentation.
Well, we have a few callers who'd like to talk about some of their favorites. Let's hear from Joseph in San Francisco. Hi, Joseph. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of give a quick shout-out to some of the European comics, like Asterix de Gaulle and Tintin. I grew up in Europe as a child in the 70s, and at that time, the first-run Asterix comics were sold in hardback. I think France, especially, and other parts of Europe really considered the art form of comic as a real art form and took it seriously, and I've started rereading some of the early Asterix books and Tintin books to my 7-year-old son, and they really hold up very well. I mean, they're very smartly written, and some of the there's an edge to the humor. The original Asterix books were written by a guy named René Goscinny, who died, I think, in 1980. But they're just very, very smart and written to to be enjoyed and appreciated by kids and adults as well. And I think kind of paved the way for a lot of the graphic novels that came afterwards.
What draws you to graphic novels?
What's that?
What draws you to graphic novels?
Well, I think I'm a visual person anyways. I think that graphic novels, the illustrations have a way of kind of capturing the imagination and sparking ideas and interest in a way that just reading alone doesn't do. I think they kind of add to each other in a really exciting way.
Well, thank you for calling in, Joseph.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Amir Joseph was talking about a few graphic novels in Europe, and your book, Zahra's Paradise, has been translated into 12 languages around the world. I understand that the reception overseas has just overwhelmed you in a way.
Yeah, it's been unbelievable. We had, you know, well, France is the land of the BD, of the bande dessinée, as they call it, Asterix and all of these. So the tradition, the visual tradition of the graphic novel there is very rich and deep. Belgium also. But what also astonished me was the reception in Germany and Spain. And I asked one of the German reporters, why do you care so much about Zahra's Paradise? And there, what she said to me really stayed. She said, we have had experience with evil, and we want to be able to see it quickly and understand it and internalize and interpret it. Mm-hmm. So I think the European, it's not just the sort of visual tradition. I think Europe's experience with war and suffering has also given works like Zahra's Paradise, which are really, really intense political works at some level, tremendous resonance. In America, the debate about Iran is largely being dominated by the nuclear question. Mm-hmm. And this is about human rights. The fact of the matter is that the Islamic Republic has killed more Iranians than it's killed anybody else, right? And that just gets completely lost. So again, the graphic novel allowed us to focus very tightly on the story of a single Iranian. But in the back of the book, we were able to list the name of 16,901 people who have been killed by the Islamic Republic. So it's not just the graphic novel. For me, it's a political device. It's a subversive political art form. And if you look, for instance, picking up on what Paul was saying at the French Revolution, if you look at the role of the pamphleteers during the French Revolution, it was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And graphic novels are part of that because you need to speak quickly, you need to speak to important issues, and you need to do it in real time. So you can't afford the novelist's luxury of producing something 3 years or 2 years after the event. You want art to allow you to pounce into the event. So
that is Amir. He is co-author of Zahra's Paradise. It's about a mother's quest for a missing son in the aftermath of Iran's stolen election. And I'd love for you after the break to talk about the one area of your book which depicts the Evin prison. And it's quite elaborate, really pretty intense, actually. So I'll ask you to talk about that and just how you came up with this idea. And we're also talking today with Paul Buell. He's founder of the Oral History of the American Left Archive at New York University. He's the author of 42 books and non-nonfiction books focusing on everything from Che to Studs Terkel's working to Emma Goldman. And if you'd like to join us, talk about some of your favorites, what makes a graphic novel unique, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255.
This is a rebroadcast. Please, no calls.
Feedback at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
It's the end of another year, a time when you may be thinking about charitable giving to the many worthy causes and organizations that you believe in. We hope that KALW is on your list and that you consider making a tax-deductible gift at our website, kalw.org. Whether you're renewing your membership or offering us an additional gift, we thank you for your support.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the power of graphic novels. How do images change the art of storytelling? What really makes them unique? What can we learn from graphic journalism? And we'd love to hear from you if you've got some favorites. What really draws you to a graphic novel? What might you be able to learn from a graphic novel that you wouldn't learn from a book? Or maybe, I mean, for example, Amir was just saying that so much of the attention in the U.S. when it comes to Iran is about nuclear weapons. But in his book, he's really talking about human rights abuses. He's talking about the prisons, the uprising, the election. So we'd love to hear from you when you're thinking about his history and politics, what you can learn from a graphic novel that you might not be able to learn from prose. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255.
This is a rebroadcast. Please, no calls.
You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Amir is an Iranian-American human rights activist. He's co-author of Zahra's Paradise, A Missing Son, A Stolen Election, Is This Iran? We're also joined by Paul Buell, author and editor of 42 books and non-nonfiction comic art books, including The Beats, A Graphic History, Che, A Graphic Biography, and Studs Terkel's Working. And before we get back to calls, Amir, I just wanted you to sort of describe the scene of the Evin prison in Tehran. And why don't you tell us how you came up with these images?
Well, these images were the work of a lifetime. And really, it was the fact that it's all come together is a testimony to Khalil's genius. When I was a kid, I basically saw people vanish in Evin prison. And since then, the crane has become essentially a symbol of death. You see dozens of Iranians hanging on cranes all the time. For me, the question was, well, how did the crane become the symbol of Iran, the symbol of justice? And it's almost like the hand of God lifting people off the earth. And it's kind of a modern lynching. So the idea was, okay, instead of condemning Evin and all of this, let's show how it operates. And what are the ideas that go into a prison? It's language. It's the words that get attached to prisoners. Spy, infidel, you know, all of these things that got attached to the protesters. It's time. Punishment is measured in terms of time. And then it's a whole process from... So much of Zahra's Paradise is, okay, all these Iranians poured into the streets. We saw the joy. We saw the strength. We saw the unity. What happened? What were they risking? 3 million people, what were they willing to risk? And what they were willing to risk was going into this monstrous judicial system. From the point of arrest to the point where whatever sentence is attached to them. And I wanted to show not just how horrid the prison system is, but what it took to pour out into the streets of Tehran, what it was that they were resisting. And Khalil miraculously put the whole thing together. So it's an integration, if you will, of our concepts of time, punishment, language, all of this in a single page.
And in this page, you have people on a conveyor belt going into the mouth of Khomeini.
Yes.
And it's just his huge face eating these people.
Yes. Well, you know, the Ayatollahs in Iran rule in the name of the Messiah who comes at the end of time. And in the meanwhile, what they're doing is they're attaching, they've turned time into an instrument of punishment and despair and sorrow. So time is at the heart of the battle for the future of Iran.
And Paul, what about that? Amir was just talking about what gets the most attention in this country about Iran, and he was hoping that this book draws attention to the prisons and the torture and the sheer brutality. Can you talk a little bit about the void that graphic novels can sometimes fill?
Yeah, well, we have a little confluence here. I would say the comic book I've done that's reached the most people, A People's History of the American Empire, which is an adaptation of Howard Zinn's famous People's History of the U.S., has a chunk of a chapter toward the end about the overthrow of Mossadegh by the American CIA, bringing about the Shah, of course, most directly, and all the horrors that follow. so we can find this trail of crimes all the way back to Washington, D.C., and the plans of the U.S. government in the early 1950s to keep control of oil and control of the Middle East more generally. I think that Joe Sacco was the one in recent times, by his books on the Middle East, or rather on the Balkans, and then another book on the Middle East, but most importantly on the Balkans, of the journalist who bravely goes out and sketches, apparently pencil sketches, with people in the midst of this moiling activity, much of which apparently makes no sense, people killing other people who were their relatives only a few years before. And then comes back to his studio and renders those pencil drawings into a really terrific non-fictional graphic novel. Now, what does that do that a documentary film can't do? I think that Amir's probably better suited to answer the question than me. But I think it's more how the material is presented. It has some kinds of narrative possibilities, narrative details, that can do things that are more difficult for a filmmaker, because a documentary filmmaker is stuck with whatever she or he has taken, whereas the scriptwriter and the artist can develop these things from their imagination. And maybe just one particular point. Of course, many documentary films have done stories of one person or one family, but the ability of the capability of the comic artist and writer to develop the story as a story, elaborating a bit fictionally where they need to, or perhaps not elaborating, is a real moment. And also for the comic writer and artist to do it from their point of view and have a sort of dialogue with these people is not any better or worse than the documentary filmmaker, but takes it from a different angle.
That is Paul Buell. We're also joined by Amir, author of Zahra's Paradise. And let's hear from a few more callers about their favorites and what draws them to graphic novels. Let's go to Jason in Salinas. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. I just wanted to comment on R. Crumb's The Book of Genesis exhibit. It recently was in San Jose, and I was able to go experience that art exhibit, and very much was in the graphic novel form. And it was just so powerful, not only for me as a Christian, just bringing forward the story of Genesis in a graphic way that was very lively and really caused me to reflect on some different parts of the Genesis story in greater detail. But as I looked around the exhibit and saw people from all different walks of life, all different faiths, just looking at this graphic depiction and really just sort of you could see sort of the excitement and the intrigue in their eyes as they went from frame to frame and from page to page. And I really think that it speaks to this power that the graphic novel medium can have just to really bring a story to life in a way that maybe otherwise it would not be given the same ability.
You know, I remember reading that actually took over 4 years to complete.
Yeah, he said it made him $1 a page because he took so many hours with each page.
Wow.
I've known Robert for more than 30 years and followed his work carefully, and I think it's his masterpiece.
So much work goes into these. Zahir, you spent 2 years on yours.
Khalil, in particular. I mean, I joke with people that for some of the major frames in this, I would say, you know, Khalil John, I'd like you to draw 3 million people in the streets and then, all right, scorched riverbed. And then he has, you know, all I've done is written 4 words and he's got to draw 3 million faces, you know.
With so much detail.
With such detail and love.
On the pockets and the hands and some of the wisps of the hair.
Yes.
And so much detail.
So it's astonishing. And that's one of the, you know, on the question, the one of the beauties of the graphic novel, as I've discovered it, is that unlike a documentary film or any film, you can actually slow down and watch a panel at your own pace, you know, and then you move forwards. Whereas in a film, it forces the pace on you. In a graphic novel, if something strikes you, you slow down, you let it in. And if something's not so interesting, you can speed up, you know. So the fast forward button is internal. It's not external.
Right. Well, thank you again for calling, Jason. Let's hear from Michael in Monterey. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
I was just going to, I mean, and I know a lot of people know this, and I wouldn't be surprised if at Occupy Wall Street, you know, there were many floating around book of The Watchmen. There's so many parallels of today. I mean, you can see that in the 80s, that was floating around. If you look in those panels, there are people in the streets, you know, blaming and rightfully so upset at the people who are supposed to watch over them, much like people are kind of blaming their politicians or prime ministers in other parts of the world.
Right.
And I see the parallels between that book, and it's not a small wonder that people are wearing Guy Fawkes masks. Mm-hmm. You know, you see those, and it seems like in the 80s, which is parallel to what's today with the fascism in some parts of culture, and people all wanting to have a voice and speak out all at once, and you see that in those books, and you can see it today, you see it on the news. And it was at like the same time in the 80s that Miller was saying that how media almost trivialized important things, like in The Dark Knight. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are comic books in the sense of superheroes and stuff, but they were making profound statements about society that those artists were witnessing. And to myself, the only recent book that I've seen that has been turned into a television show, which is using a gimmick to talk about people, is The Walking Dead, myself. And I think, I mean, if you get past the gimmick plot of zombies and you look at the different choices that everyone has to make in those books, talking about a world where everyone's had a cushy for so long and now things are different. And I'll take any responses off the air.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Michael. Sorry about the bad line. That's actually on our end. Paul, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, within the trade comics, within the main commercial comics, not alternative comics, the dark side developed by Frank Miller and others, as the caller said, in the 80s and 90s, is the most important artistic trope. A sort of later-day parallel to noir films, which were very much a product of the left in the late 1940s. Frank Miller and others are not particularly political progressive, really progressive, but they captured this very, very dark feeling, denying that this is morning in America, and so on and so forth. And there are a lot of angles from this that are wonderful and hilarious. In Wisconsin, the great struggle against the governor led months of mass marches, but one of the best was by teenagers who had a zombie march. They turned zombieism into a political format. So darkness is all around us, and no kidding. But there are many creative things to do with it, and we'll see what young artists manage to do.
And is there, do the graphic novelists that you know, how do they feel about like DC Comics and some of these sort of blockbuster type graphic novels?
Well, in general, they don't like them at all. And I have to say that would include me. But on the other hand, it's also true that it was difficult to grow up and read comics that were only Funny Animal comics or Archie and such banal stuff and escape a certain sensibility that came with reading the drama and the action. And secondly, it was the vast commercial success of superhero characters made into films that in part inspired the interest of publishers and others in the graphic novel, because you got a whole lot of stuff on the financial pages of the New York Times and Los Angeles Times, and it sort of dripped over into the book review section. Mm. So that role, which artistically to me and most artists is uninteresting, nevertheless can have an important impact.
Yeah, I think going back to Michael's point on the occupied movement, mm-hmm. Because it's similar in some ways to what's going on in Iran, there's a real moment that we're experiencing where the boundaries between representation and misrepresentation are being renegotiated, where traditionally you elect someone and they're supposed to represent you. But then you look at some of the elected officials around the world, and even in the U.S., Ahmadinejad, Gaddafi, Berlusconi, and they're like sort of grotesque, absurd cartoon characters in a way. And so it's funny that we were going back to art, cartoons, to reclaim this time our humanity and our own common sense and dignity. And in Zahra's Paradise especially, you know, so much of the world's perception of Iran is through Ahmadinejad. And so we wanted to show, no, look at your average Iranians, the taxi driver, the Xerox shop owner, you know, they are Iran, not these guys, not these guys who distort its image, you know. So this goes to, I think, what Paul is saying too. It's like art can reclaim our humanity in a way, and we're seeing it both in the protests and in the art representing it.
Wonderful points, better than I could, but to which I'd add that the reality of what happened to journalists in New York City last night and night before compared to the description of it in the New York Times is so dramatic, so phenomenally dramatic, that something else has to fill the void. And a lot of it is alternative journalism on this radio station, among others, but some of it doubtless is new graphic material in the making.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because we will talk about that on Friday. And for listeners who might not have been paying attention, journalists were completely blocked out from the raid in Zuccotti Park in New York City. A number of journalists actually were arrested. Mm-hmm. So we will also be talking about that. Thank you for the call, Michael. We have an email from Lynn who says, please mention the other grandfather of the graphic novel in Japan, Osamu Tezuka. Many know his Astro Boy series, but he also did an 8-volume book, over 400 pages each volume, about the life of the Buddha. It's an incredible story written for everyone. Truly, one picture is worth 1,000 words. And Lynn says, thank you to all the artists and the writers. Thanks for the email, Lynn. And if you'd like to email us, we have about 10 minutes left. It's feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also give us a call at 866-798.
This is a rebroadcast. Please, no calls.
If you'd like to talk about one of your favorite graphic novels, or what really draws you to graphic novels, how do images change the art of storytelling? What makes these graphic novels so unique? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And today we are joined by Amir, co-author of Zahra's Paradise. And this is a mother's quest for a missing son in the aftermath of Iran's stolen elections. We're also joined by Paul Buell. He is founder of the Oral History of the American Left Archive at NYU. He has been involved in nine nonfiction comic art books, including The Beats, A Graphic History, and A Dangerous Woman, the graphic biography of Emma Goldman. And let's hear from another caller. Let's go to Paul in Berkeley. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. This is perhaps trivial compared to the work Amir is doing, and I want to first salute the Iranian people and their struggle. But when I was a kid in the late 50s, I read a book by no left-winger, Al Capp, called The Bald Eagle, I-G-G-L-E. And it was about a little creature that if you stared it in its eyes, you had to tell the truth. And finally, the feds had to come and eliminate it because it was too dangerous. It was a very lovely and funny little Abner story. But it was kind of in a graphic novel format. So I just wondered if your guests had anything to say about that.
Well, there's a granddaughter of Al Capp who lives in Monterey and is trying to make a documentary film about his life. And the truth is, until around 1960, he was still a sort of New Dealer politically, and was on the leftward edge and sort of an avant-garde-ish kind of person. And then something, a variety of bad things happened to him, and by the time the Goldwater campaign came, he became a flaming right-winger and sort of a nut, and ended his life in a most unhappy fashion. But some of his extended works could be called miniature graphic novels, and I, too, in the early 1950s, found them really quite amazing and hilariously libertarian, you might say.
Great story. Well, thank you for that. I'd like to check out his work and that documentary. Thanks for calling in, Paul. Let's go next to Randy in San Francisco. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Listen, I just last week I went to a performance of the graphic novel in a small community college down in Fremont, California. And what they had done, the fellow that had produced it had studied Batman for like 25 years, and he took all the Batman comics and put them up on a screen, almost like a slideshow. And he had 10 performers in front of it that were darkened, but you could actually see them in the audience. And they were all the characters of all these Batman different stories that they put on. And I just thought it was absolutely fascinating. The music was out of this world. And Warner Brothers was there along with DC Comics. And apparently they're trying to put this thing into a full stage production. So I don't know if you've ever heard of anything like that or not, but I'm going to go off the phone and listen to you guys on the air, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, the theatrical pieces have arrived based on comics. Ben Catchor, a New York-based person, has done them in various places and is just absolutely wonderful. He writes the libretto and the music and singing that goes along with it. But so do a number of other people. I should have mentioned Seth Tobachman, one of a group that publishes an annual comic called World War III Illustrated. It's the most political of all the comics. And his latest book is called Understanding the Crash. But he, too, goes around, shows a PowerPoint or a slide or what, and some form of his comics. And then there is music and performance of some kind. So I don't think this existed 5 years ago, this format.
Hmm.
And it seems to have caught fire. The theatrical world is a lot smaller and stranger than films and even, in a way, best-selling or well-selling comics. But it's something important to keep an eye on.
That's a great point. We've had some of the Germans, for instance, when they were doing a TV show on Zahra's Paradise, they actually put voice and music to it, moved the camera into the images, and then shifted from the images to the reality from which we were drawing. And I was just stunned at the performing power that once you put some, you know, there's a lot more that can happen with graphic novels.
So they did a TV show based on the book in Germany?
Pretty much. I mean, it was a small segment. It was a 3-minute segment. But they wanted to show that, you know, we wanted to, Khalil had drawn Neda, for instance, off the images from, Neda was the woman who was killed on the streets of Tehran, beautiful woman. And we saw her, the flutterings of her eyebrows. So we have a section on Neda in Zahra's Paradise. And what they did was that they took that and put the actual event, merged reality and the graphic novel, which was just, you know, the potential. I mean, we're almost scraping at things, you know. What one other thing, just a quick, because Paul's historical perspective's gotten me thinking. Khalil, my co-author, always mentions how much he's been influenced by Persian miniature, not just the European traditions, but also when you look at Persian miniature, the poetry and the images are almost always telling a story. And the depth of this desire to tell these stories, I think ultimately comes to it. It's almost as though if it's graphic novel, documentary film, poetry, whatever, doesn't matter. Tell the story.
Well, tell the story, and then where does it reach? And Paul, with your experience in focusing on so many subjects, from the Beats to Emma Goldman, have you received any surprise letters or emails from readers who maybe didn't know much about this history but learned about it through the graphic novel?
Well, I would say that on Amazon, there are people shocked to see they ordered a book by related to my work by Howard Zinn, The People's History of American Empire comic, and their comment is, "And then I learned it was a comic!" Exclamation mark! I'm so insulted! 2 exclamation marks! In other words, there are a fair number of people who just can't grapple with the idea of a graphic novel, and it's just beyond them. And I would say, I'm 67, I would say a whole lot of people over the age of 50 grew up with their parents forbidding them to read comic books and never quite got over it, or forbade their children to read comic books. So that's always a surprise to me, because comics were never not part of my life. But I would also say, for quite a number of people, the phenomena of graphic novels is so new to them as well that they have to teach themselves how to read in a new way. And that's really something. But my last valuable thought here, I suspect, is one delivered by a famous a poet, Ezra Pound, which was that the poem begins in antiquity, way before antiquity, with the story of the people, as Amir is suggesting, and it always included dance and song. In other words, that's where oral history begins, that's where poetry begins, that's where everything begins. And if there's a virtue in our much-endangered postmodern age, is that the formal limits between all of these are coming down, and the possibility of merging them and creating new forms is greater now than it's ever been.
And when does your Robin Hood book come out? I was just looking at it at PM Press, and the cover is great.
Well, it's supposed to be available in a couple weeks.
Oh, good.
And another book full of comics, some comics, is called It Started in Wisconsin. We like to claim the entire Occupy movement began with the occupation of the State House here. And I'm working with several artists to create an online comic for the spring for high school students around the country, which tries to relate the 50-year history of the Port Huron Statement, the origins of SDS, Student for Democratic Society, to what's going on with young people today, and perhaps to be able to use the web as a way to teach about comics and teach through comics and begin to offer new voices.
That's great. And Amir, Zahra's Paradise, do you think that you're going to embrace the graphic novel medium from here on out?
Oh, I'm going to embrace whatever comes my way, for sure. But one thing, very quick.
Do we have about 20 seconds.
Okay. The graphic novel is increasingly part of movements.
And
I think one can't separate it from movements.
That is Amir. He is co-author of Zahra's Paradise, A Missing Son, A Stone Election, and Is This Iran? Paul Buell is the author of many graphic novels. His latest, it'll come out in just a couple weeks, is Robin Hood, People's Outlaw and Forest Hero, A Graphic Guide. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you
so much.
And
bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
And thanks for your emails and phone calls. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow.
What was your story of the year? On the Next Your Call, it's our last Friday Media Roundtable of the year. We've invited a few of our favorite journalists to talk about the best reporting this year, from the uprisings around the globe to economic uncertainty. We'll also discuss the most undercover stories of the year and our hopes for 2012. We'll be joined by The Guardian's Martin Chuloff, Alternet's Joshua Holland, and McClatchy's Kevin Hall. It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.